Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Down past Cardston, near the Canada-U.S. border, lies the Jefferson Moraine, a large area of hills and dips where grasshoppers and cattle share the terrain. Now, a unique partnership between Ducks Unlimited, the Nature Conservancy of Canada, and the Alberta Conservation Association is turning part of the region back into natural grassland. This is with the hope of filling the potholes with water, providing habitat for ducks and other critters that once made the Jefferson Moraine their home. And there's lots of science happening there, too. Biologist Linda Cerny is collecting inventories on birds and other species. And graduate student Meg McCluskey is testing essential oils to find a natural treatment against grasshopper infestations. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. On a clear day, you can look out across Jefferson Moraine and see Chief Mountain, which is just across the border in Montana. Nestled up against the Rocky Mountains, this hilly region south of Lethbridge was once filled with prairie potholes that supported a large population of pintailed ducks. But with farming, cattle grazing, and irrigation projects, the potholes are now dry. The ducks and much of the other biodiversity in the region has all but disappeared. Ducks Unlimited Canada has recently spearheaded an effort to restore the wetlands in the Jefferson Moraine. Along with the Nature Conservancy of Canada and the Alberta Conservation Association, the consortium has purchased 5 sections of land, which they now call the Jefferson Community Pasture. Morgan Stromsmo is the restoration agronomist with Ducks Unlimited, who's in charge of the project.
The main duck at risk on the prairies is the prairie pintail. All the other waterfowl pretty much respond very well to wet years. The pintails traditionally responded very well to the wet and dry cycle, and their populations followed it very well. Until probably the last 25 years, they've started to see a disconnect there, and the waterfowl or the pintail are starting to decline, and they're continuing to decline to this day. And we really don't have a very good handle on it. So one of the things that we're really noticing is that there's some kind of an impact occurring on the uplands. It's not the wetlands. The wetlands, for the most part, are intact, but there's something happening on the uplands, and we don't have a very good handle of that. But we know that they do like perennial cover.
We're looking at these maps here, and it looks like most of the area has been farmed, and so that's been cleared, and also a number of the wetlands have been drained. What are you going to do then to try and restore this?
What we try to do is we try to work with producers cooperatively. We did a very large land purchase down south of Cardston, about 2,500 acres roughly in that range. And it was all farmed. A little bit of it was in hay, but for the most part, it was all cultivated land. We're converting it back to tame grass and native grass, and we're going to look at developing a community pasture scenario that will actually incorporate local producers. And portion of them having to be involved in this is that they'll have to convert their land back to perennial cover. And they'll be able to use it under a grazing or haying scenario. So it won't be, you know, they'll have to put it aside to use our land. So I think it's a very cooperative venture.
What's special about the Jefferson Moraine?
Jefferson Moraine is quite special and unique in that it's a height of land within the Milk River Ridge. It's a knob and kettle formation, very morainal. So there's lots of wetland basins in the area. One of the things that makes it unique for us to work in too is that there's a lot of drainage has occurred in this area too, and that's one of the other things that we're working with producers is to cooperatively restore a lot of these drained wetlands.
How would you do that?
Well, that'll be part of the agreement when we work with a producer. We try to make the offer enticing enough for them to want to work with us, but part of the agreement will be that they'll have to restore the wetlands, and part of that's going to be an education process to show them that there is a value other than just for waterfowl, those wetlands being intact.
Now, this is part of a bigger scheme of things. What is the situation beyond the Jefferson Moraine?
The Jefferson Moraine is located, like I said earlier, in the Milk River Ridge. The Milk River Ridge is one of our targeted pintail areas. It's very attractive to the pintail, and that's because of the morainal area that it is with all the wetlands in it. We've broken down the Milk River Ridge into 13 sort of bite-sized chunks or landscapes that we work in, and Jefferson Moraine is just one of the 13 that we're going to be working in.
I was down looking through the area, and there's a graduate student from the University of Lethbridge who's doing some work on aromatic oils to try and deal with the grasshopper problem. How did you end up with a grasshopper problem down there?
That one kind of hit us by surprise when we purchased the land last year, and we didn't do a lot of work with the land except just get it ready for seeding this coming spring. So we did some chem fallow out there, and in one of our inspections we met with a producer that was quite concerned that we weren't doing anything with the grasshoppers with the outbreak last year. So we decided we needed to really do something here, and instead of going the traditional spraying with Desis or Laura's Ban or any of those products, we decided let's try and make it a little bit more environmental. So we brought in Dan Johnson, the doctor from Lethbridge Research Center, who's a grasshopper specialist. And we came down with him and said, you know, what can we do here? And we decided that, you know what, we could look at some other, you know, non-chemical measures to try and do some grasshopper control. So out of that came the research study with Meg McCluskey, which is, I think, is going to be pretty neat. And I think it works into our sort of mandate, too, of, you know, just the environmentally friendly practices out here.
Now, it's not just Ducks Unlimited. You've got the Alberta Conservation Association involved and also the Nature Conservancy of Canada. What's brought you all together?
We've been actually working very closely with the Nature Conservancy on a lot of other projects. And what makes this one kind of unique is that our partnership with the Nature Conservancy is the Nature Conservancy normally doesn't buy cultivated land on its own. You know, they'll buy it as part of another parcel, but they're normally looking at sort of pristine type landscapes that are still in native cover. One of the things that we said, you know, if you come into this agreement with us, we'll look at restoring this back to native cover. And I think we've got some confidence in both sides of our thing, that they have some confidence in us that, you know, we'll be able to make this a very worthwhile project. And I think they thought that it was very worthwhile to be involved. I think similar with the Alberta Conservation Association, we've worked cooperatively with them since the inception of that organization and before when it was Bucks for Wildlife. We've been working together on habitat initiatives. And I think, you know, they seen too that it was potentially a very worthwhile venture.
Well, I would think that not just the ducks are going to benefit from this, but all kinds of other animals.
Absolutely. 80% of all of our wildlife in Alberta use wetlands at, you know, one part of their life cycle or another. Incorporating this into a perennial cover scenario is going to attract all kinds of wildlife, from large ungulates down to small mammals, invertebrates. The invertebrate population will be changing too with the restoration of a lot of these wetland areas.
What do you see as being the challenge for you right now?
The biggest challenge, as always, is to actually gain trust in an area. And this is a fairly new area for us to be working in. The three groups, you know, our cooperative here came in and purchased a very large parcel of land. Producers are always a little bit leery about conservation organizations, you know, and environmentalists, SARA legislation, all that stuff sort of tied together. So the biggest challenge we got in here is to gain the trust of the producers down here. And it's something that we work hard at. And, you know, you have to be, you know, very upfront with producers, very honest with them, and tell them what you're going to be doing here. And that's been our biggest challenge. And it's not just here is our challenge, but our challenge everywhere.
Is your goal then to purchase as much land as you possibly can through here, or to perhaps work with the producers? They keep the land, but they do some things for you.
Yeah, our land purchase in this area is probably pretty much complete now. We're going to develop this scenario into a community pasture scenario and actually do what we call a land use exchange, where we'll actually allow them use on our property to actually get some kind of conservation use on their property. And when I say a conservation use on their property, that would mean putting their ground back into perennial cover and either haying it or grazing it.
So they can still make some money.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we always want to keep this in mind, that we're trying to make this a working landscape, that it works for the producer and it works for the conservation of waterfowl and other wildlife. if we try and come in here and purchase as much land as we can from a conservation perspective, it just doesn't work. We don't have enough money to do it. And politically, it's not a very good thing. Our supporters for our company, which is a nonprofit, comes from the grassroots, comes from the producers out here. So it's important that we work cooperatively with producers to try and, you know, we may not get 100% of what we want, they may not get 100% of what they want, but we meet in the middle. And it works very well.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Morgan Stromsmo, a restoration agronomist with Ducks Unlimited Canada and project leader for the Jefferson Community Pasture. The Alberta Conservation Association is one of the partners in the Jefferson Conservation Pasture near Cardston along the Milk River Ridge. There is hardly a tree in sight in this region, which is characterized by hummocks, dry grass, and the chirping of grasshoppers. Linda Cerny is a wildlife technician with the ACA's Lethbridge office, and it's her job to do wildlife inventories for the Jefferson Project.
This year, I started the first breeding bird survey, which involves the bird transects. And I'm also asking members who are already out there, like the University of Lethbridge will be out there doing some amphibian and invertebrate studies. The research station is doing their grassland studies, or grasshopper studies, and asking them to also keep track of the wildlife that's out there. We're hoping that we can get some ungulates like deer and antelope sightings as well.
What have you found so far?
So far, it's a lot of the grassland birds, which include horned larks, savannah sparrows. There's been a couple chestnut-colored longspurs. I've heard some Spragg's pipits, which are classified as species of concern, which is good to see. There's been some barred sparrows. A lot of seagulls, or as we call them, just gulls. We've also seen a lot of waterfowl, which include canvasbacks and northern pintail. There's been Wilson's phalaropes sighted on the property. And wildlife species, we saw antelope out there and a couple of deer, which is good to see. And basically, we want to get the data and find out what's coming into the area.
I was out there yesterday, and the thing that really struck me is all the little hills and the hills and valleys, and which I guess comes with being a moraine. It's very, very dry, and you have to wonder, well, where would the ducks and the other birds come from? Why would they want to be there?
Well, at one time, as I mentioned, these little ponds and potholes were once plugged for the cultivated fields, and Ducks Unlimited have plugged them, and it's allowed for water to come in. This year, we were really fortunate to have many of those filled with water, and as the season goes on, as you know, it's been 30-plus degree temperatures, and so the grasses out there are very, very dry. And through the whole stage of cultivation, it'll be interesting to see if the birds will start to come in once the grasses are starting to grow.
There's not an awful lot of trees. Where did these birds go? Where did they nest? What did they do?
Most of the birds in that area will probably be ground nesting species. As you know, by your own viewing of the property, there's not much for shrubs or trees. And what shrubs and trees are there? You'll probably find your Swainson's hawks and maybe the odd owl that will nest in the tree. But most of the species now, as the grasses are growing, will be your grassland species, such as your savannah sparrows, your horned larks. There'll be waterfowl that do nest on the ground as well. Those are the type of species that you'll probably see more so than the riparian ones, which are your woodpeckers or your robins, because they tend to like the shrub areas.
Do you expect that once these little potholes start to fill up with water again, that it will be more utilized, that it will attract more and more wildlife?
Oh, yes, I definitely believe that the water, once it does fill up all these little potholes and the little lakes that used to be in the property, will attract more waterfowl species. It's a matter of finding them. You know, these birds, they come back every year and they know where they the water is. They just need to learn where the water sources are again. And I'm sure we'll see a lot more waterfowl, especially the pintail, which is the prime reason why this property was purchased by Ducks Unlimited.
This area is going to be revegetated now with the native species rather than the agricultural crops. Does that make a difference for these birds?
There will be a difference. You'll see more diversity of species coming in as a result of the native species. Birds like long-billed curlews will come in, more Spragg's pipits. You might actually see a lot more species of concern as a result of the native grasses. The cultivated fields don't tend to attract the diversity of birds that come in because they can't really see through the crop, and the native grasses allow for a lot of visual to happen. And native grasslands are really unique. There's, in the prairie region, 80% of the prairies take up a lot of space, but they also bring in a lot of diverse species, not just birds, but also other wildlife as well. I was very fortunate to see a sandhill crane utilizing the property this year, which is a wonderful sighting to see because there hasn't been that many sightings of these species in the area. So native grasses will allow more species to come in.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming and taking the time to talk to me.
That was Linda Cerny, a wildlife technician with the Alberta Conservation Association in Lethbridge. For the last couple of years, southern Alberta especially has been plagued by grasshoppers, and that's one of the first problems Ducks Unlimited ran into when it started reseeding native grasses into the sections it was trying to restore in the Jefferson Moraine. The grasshoppers devoured the new grass. But spraying with traditional pesticides was not an option, because these would harm other wildlife. Meg McCluskey is a graduate student working under Dr. Dan Johnson, a grasshopper specialist at the Agriculture Canada Research Station in Lethbridge, and also an adjunct professor at the university there. Her research is based on finding a more natural solution to control grasshoppers by testing essential oils. I joined Meg at the Jefferson Moraine study site near Cardston, where we rode ATVs to check pitfall traps for insects. With over 100 species of grasshoppers, it's really only two-stripe and clearwing that cause problems for farmers.
So this is our other main pest species here at the site. It's a Camnula pellucida. It's called a clearwing grasshopper. And there are three types of shorthorn grasshoppers. There's band-winged, which is what this is. And then there's melanoplin, they're spur-throated, which is what the two-striped is. And then there's slant-faced. And the slant-faced will hear, it's actually one of the ones that is here is, what is it called?
Clubhorn,
yeah. And it's got really obvious clubs on its antennae, and it makes a nice little whirring sound in the grass. It kind of, if you don't know anything about snakes, you can sometimes think it's a little rattlesnake. But this one here, the clearwing, you can see it,
oops,
it's on your shirt now.
There you go.
No, I lost
went them. This way.
I jumped back onto me. But yeah.
You keep losing these guys.
They're hard to hold on to. They like to, as soon as they see the light, they just jump right out, even if you have them in your hand like that. But anyway, they have, the clearwing have obvious kind of lines on their tegmen that come down and form a V. The two-striped have that also, so sometimes people can confuse them. But the two-striped have really obvious lines on their pronotum. There's a, on the thorax, it goes head, thorax, abdomen. On the thorax, the grasshoppers have a shield. And that shield is called the pronotum. And on the pronotum, on the two-stripe, you can really see that there's two stripes. And those two stripes actually run down the pronotum and then down the wings to form a little V. But on the clear wing, the stripes aren't usually on the pronotum. They're just on the wings. And also the clear wing are usually a lighter color than the two-stripe.
Oh, there goes our buddy. That one you were just holding, what stage was it at?
That was an adult. When you can see that they have fully developed wings, they're adult grasshoppers, yeah.
There's quite a difference in their sizes.
Yeah, the clearwing is quite a bit smaller than the two-stripe. The two-stripe is the biggest one we'll find here. The clearwing's quite a bit smaller than that, yeah.
Where are we going next?
We're going to go to our next pitfall site to see how many beetles and other little critters we've got in there.
Our morning was spent driving up and down the dry hills, the hot sun beating down on us, and the view clouded by smoke blowing from the forest fires in the mountains not all that far away. Finally, sitting in the shade of the few scrubby trees that we could find, I had a chance to ask Meg about her research on essential oils.
The treatments that we've tried are basically plant extracts. Neem is one that has a lot of research has been done, some on grasshoppers and some on other insect pests, and then essential oils. And there's been quite a bit of research done on essential oils in terms of other insects, lots of beetles and flies, but nothing is known so far on their effects on Orthoptera and grasshoppers. So what we're doing is trying to test their effects in the field and see if we can control the grasshopper problem without, you know, wiping out all the grasshoppers, but just controlling the population a bit.
Now, the work that you're doing is also going to be the basis of your master's thesis. How have you set out the research here?
Well, what we've done here is we've looked for areas where there's high density of grasshoppers, and then we've selected those areas and flagged them out, and then done treatments. So randomized treatments of the selected essential oils and neem, and then sprayed that on. So we count how many grasshoppers are in an area, and then we spray the area, and then we go back and count and see if we brought down the numbers of grasshoppers in that area.
How would these essential oils and the neem, how do they actually work?
Well, the essential oils so far have shown in other studies on other types of insects that they either have antifeedant or pesticidal properties. So sometimes they'll just cause the insects to not eat. Or neem has actually shown that if you spray it on grasshoppers when they're in younger stages, like juvenile stages, that they actually won't molt. So they eventually die just because it interrupts their growth. But and as an antifeedant, same thing. Sometimes they will eat, but they'll eat at a slower rate, or they'll eat, but they'll die from the eating.
What is neem?
Neem is also an extract from the neem tree that I think is from Asia. It's Asiaderact indica is the tree, and it's from the neem seed. They just extract this oil that has shown to act as an antifeedant to grasshoppers, but it's also obviously really low toxicity because people use it as a topical treatment for arthritis, and I think people actually drink it in tea in Africa and Asia also, so it's obviously pretty low toxicity to humans.
What are some of the challenges that you've faced this year?
The challenges have been many. Weather, of course, is always a challenge. The grasshoppers were late this year because we had so much moisture and cooler temperatures in the early spring. But of course, we want to test our stuff on grasshoppers that are still in their nymph stages, and it's been so hot that the grasshoppers have developed pretty quickly. So, but beyond that, just trying to get the sprayer, you know, we were spraying our essential oils mixed with water, and so you can't spray when you have 20 kilometer winds, and of course we're in sort of the Chinook area, so we always had 30 to 40 kilometer west winds, and having winds and then the sprayers, we're spraying with quad mounted ATV mounted sprayers, and so basically everything that could go wrong did go wrong. We missing a sprayer part when we'd come out, or something is broken, or electrical problems with our connections, or it's too hot and the essential oils are so volatile that what you spray them on and 5 minutes after you can't even tell that you've put them on the ground. Just everything that could go wrong did go wrong.
Well, is that a concern, something that you might have to look at, is giving these essential oils some staying power?
Yeah, so far what we've tried is just mixing them with water and soap, but there's other ways to apply, like mixing with oil so that they stay on a bit longer. You can encapsulate in sort of micro capsules oils or or products, and then spray that on, and the capsule will then open when it comes in contact with something, so less of it will go kind of off into the air. So hopefully it will come in contact with either, with say, a grasshopper and open and then go into its cuticle.
You're doing this year. Will you have to do it again next year?
Yeah. This study was sort of preliminary. What I'll do now is go back to the lab and try some of these, maybe, you know, try the oil mixture with the essential oils and also just do more tests of different types of oils and just try and select the ones that are most effective at the lowest cost. Because what we're hoping for in the end is probably farmers on large scale won't choose to change to essential oils from pesticides, but some organic farmers, you know, would find this information useful, as well as conservation groups like Ducks Unlimited. So basically, what I'll do is try and find something in the lab that works and is effective, and try and rear grasshoppers, and then you know, test without as many variables. Like, I won't have problems with my sprayer, and I also won't have weather to contend with and that sort of thing, so I can do smaller tests and then bring this to the field again next summer with a bit more knowledge.
We've been out in the field and you've been showing me some of the different grasshoppers that are out there, and not all of them are pest species. Would these essential oils would they kill all of them, or are you looking for something that can just target the ones you don't want around? How would that work?
Well, at this site, the majority of the species we see are just the two-striped and the clearwing, the two pest species. So the largest number of grasshoppers that we're going to have a negative effect on will be those grasshoppers. But yeah, we don't have, at this point, we can't say that we're going to only, you know, that we're just going to target the two-striped and the clearwing. That would be a miracle right now. But I mean, that would be great. You know, that might be way beyond even my PhD. but yeah, at this point, no, we're just kind of blanket trying to have a negative effect on grasshoppers. But we're not even sure that the essential oils will kill the grasshoppers, even if they just slow them down. That would be, you know, that's kind of what we're looking for. But if we are able to kill grasshoppers with essential oils, the percentage of the population that we kill would be, probably wouldn't be anywhere even near 50%. What we want is to control the infestation. So we want to bring the numbers down. We don't want to wipe out the population.
Thank you very much, Meg.
Thank you.
That was Meg McCluskey, a graduate student in biological sciences at the University of Lethbridge. We were visiting her study site at the Jefferson Community Pasture. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the Alberta Conservation Association, the University of Lethbridge, the Alberta Research Council, Capital Region Innovation Center, Sustainable Forest Management Network, Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, Alberta Ingenuity, the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, the National Institute for Nanotechnology, and the Health Sciences Association of Alberta. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.